responsibility for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll bring you a special congressional roundtable featuring Brad Miller of North Carolina, Tim Ryan of Ohio, and Judy Chu of California, who will share their ideas to improve the middle class. We'll also discuss voter protection initiatives with former Obama White House communications advisor Corey Elons. But first, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island joins us. Senator, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jason. It's great to be with you.
It is an exciting time for the Democratic Party here at the National Convention in Charlotte. What have you taken away so far from the events this week?
A lot of excitement and I think some really terrific speeches. I think that Deval Patrick and Mayor Castro and the First Lady, among others, really hit it out of the park the day before yesterday. Last night, the president hit a home run. I mean, the ball's still flying. He hit it so well. And really excited about his speech. The First Lady kind of positioned the president personally, his values, where he comes from. President Clinton took the case to the Republicans with the things they're saying that just aren't true. And that leaves the president free tonight to, I think, really give a great vision speech. I hear from people who are close to the White House that he's getting some trash talk from his staff, being told, look, the First Lady hit out of the park, the president hit out of the park. If you got game, it's time to step up. Can you play with these guys? Have you got it? So I think we're going to see a really terrific speech tonight. He responds well to pressure. He delivers a great speech. I think this has been a couple of days that will really send a message to the American public.
We know that this election season is about the economy, it's about job creation, it's about a vision, not just for the country, but specifically the middle class.
Yep.
How we're going to develop the middle class, how we're going to get people back to work. Tell me what your thoughts are on those issues.
I think that the concern that a lot of Americans have that underlies these issues is that when the middle class is in distress, Washington doesn't listen. When big banks are in distress, when big corporations are in distress, well, they get all the attention in the world. And I think we need to do two things. One, we need to continue the economic recovery that the president has presided over since he has been in office, particularly in Rhode Island, which has very, very tough unemployment figures still. We need to continue to develop this. And the second thing is we need to convince people that as we do, the game is not rigged for powerful and special interests, that the middle class has a real shot. And if we can do both of those things, then I think we'll have put the country back into a really good place. And I think that's a very high responsibility for the president and for everybody who is in government these days.
How much do you think we have to change the minds of those people who might feel that the system is rigged against them, or there's no way they can make it, or there's no way they can be successful, and the American dream's out of reach? How prevalent do you think that is?
I hear it a lot more often than I would like, and I hear it very sincerely said. And I think that there are two ways to address it. One is that you've got to actually begin to get the economy to where it really should be. I mean, we're going in the right direction. But when people, as Clinton said last night, even though it's going in the right direction, they don't feel it yet. Until they feel it, it's going to be difficult. The second thing is, there's some things that are just outright wrong. They're just outright unfair, and they stand out there as emblems of what is wrong in Washington. And you've got to go after a couple of those and fix them. You cannot have a tax system that is supposed to be a progressive tax system where two-thirds of people making more than $1 million a year pay a lower tax rate than the median income American family. That is upside down. That is wrong. Everybody gets it. And we need to act on that. You have huge banks that can go off and hide behind corporate shells in Delaware and in South Dakota and market virtually poisonous products with no consumer protection, going against the interest rate laws of home states that people depend on. And at the same time, you've got kids who are trying to make their own way in college, and they can't even get rid of a loan in bankruptcy if they wanted to, and any big corporation can restructure. So you just got to find a couple of things that are important to people, that are unfair, and set them right, and that will begin, I think, to make a difference.
Let's talk about that tax system a little bit. It's clearly going to take a rule change, if you will, to implement some of those things, to change the way the tax system is now. Do you think it's realistic for people to expect it to happen anytime soon, and what is it going to take to get it done?
I actually do. If you go back to the president's last State of the Union address, it was a pretty divided Congress he was talking to. There are only two occasions that I recall in that speech where everybody in the hall stood up and applauded. One was when the president spoke for our veterans and for the men and women serving overseas. The second was when he promised to clean up the tax code. And clearly, for generations, special interests have been infiltrating their special deals and tricks and gimmicks into the tax code. And I think people are sick of it, and I think the Republicans have talked enough about lowering the rate and clearing out the special interest loopholes that they're now kind of committed. When it comes push to shove, and it's actually their special interest loopholes that are on the chopping block, I think you're going to see a lot of screaming and a lot of dodging. But they've made such a strong case conceptually that I think they're kind of boxed themselves in. So I think this is an area where we can and we must take some action.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. Senator, to the point of lobbyists, we've had conversations on this show with others before talking about the way lobbying used to be in Washington and the way that it is now, and it's much different, much more money, less talking points and more money. And I'm wondering how you think it got to be that way, and is it possible to change it? Is it something that's too far gone, that's out of control, or can we really get our hands around it and sort of reel in those things?
Citizens United is the heart of this problem. What people were concerned about in what we then thought was the bad old days was that lobbyists would make a couple of $1,000s in campaign contributions. As a result, they'd get access, they'd be able to bring somebody into a senator's or congressman's office, and they'd get to make a pitch that other people wouldn't have a chance to make. That isn't such a great system, but it's gotten so much worse since then. Post Citizens United, these corporate interests don't need to have a lobbyist give you a couple of $1,000s. They can decide that they're going to spend a couple of $1 million for you or against you in a race. And the aspect of Citizens United that I think is the most grievous and the most wrong-headed was that the court never took into consideration that a corporate interest doesn't have to execute on the threat to do that. They don't have to go up on the air with millions of dollars one way or the other. They can simply go to a candidate and say, here's a 30-second ad. Take a look at it. We're going to put $5 million behind that ad, or maybe not. The choice is yours. Do you vote on our bill, yes, the way we want you to, or not? The choice is yours. And when they close up their laptop and they walk out of the office, there'll be no trace of that conversation. There'll be no record of the spending. There'll be no ad that showed up on the radio. And yet, that is as corrupting a potential influence as you can have. And when you're talking literally millions of dollars, when you're talking potentially knocking somebody completely out of their seat, it just raises the stakes enormously, and it makes the shadow of corruption much, much darker and broader.
We've had an opportunity here this week to talk to a number of members of the House of Representatives, and I asked them, what is it like working in that body? And I want to ask you the same thing. What is it like working in the Senate with your colleagues? Is it easier to reach across the aisle and work with some of your colleagues, or do you find difficulties at this point finding common ground?
It depends on the colleague, and it depends on the issue. There are some issues that have become radioactive. It's virtually impossible to have a sensible discussion about health care, because all they want to say is Obamacare, rationing, socialized medicine, and they go straight to the talking points. On the other hand, on less charged issues like protecting our internet and our cybersecurity, I'm having very good ongoing conversations with Senator Kyle, Senator Graham, Senator Coates, Senator Blunt. I did a bipartisan brief with Senator McCain against the Citizens United decision in the United States Supreme Court. So you have to kind of find your issue. There are some people on the Republican side who want to work, who want to legislate, who want to do things right. There are a couple of bomb throwers and ideologues who simply don't want that. The thing that I see the most is that what I would call the sensible Republican cohort of the Senate is frightened of the extreme Republican cohort. And I think when that changes, then the whole tone of the Senate will change. But the sensible Republican cohort has seen too many of their colleagues knocked out by Tea Party extremism. And so there's a lot that they think is the right thing to do, that they know they should do, that would be good for our country, that they're putting their career at risk if they do it in the temper of these times. And so that's a kind of a frustration. There's a lot of goodwill in the Senate that isn't being acted on because of the shadow of fear that the Tea Party casts on the rest of the Republican Party. We Democrats tend not to appreciate that.
Lastly, Senator, before we let you go, another big issue within the Senate, the House, the White House, is the role of government, the size of government, and the federal employees who do that work. Oftentimes, they're thrown into the mix, their pay, their benefits, almost like a political football. Where do you stand on some of those issues?
Well, I think government has a really solemn obligation to deliver services as efficiently and effectively as possible. And because of the nature of the beast and because government is not as competitive an enterprise as the private sector, we tend to lag in government on those measures. So I think it's really important that there be pressure on government all the time to be more effective and to be more efficient. But the Republicans take it a step further. They question really whether government should exist. If you're in the middle class, you count on government to provide good public schools for your kids. You count on government to run a fair and safe Social Security system so that you know your retirement won't be blown in some Wall Street scam. You require on government to run a healthcare system that your elderly mom and dad can count on so they don't have to be your problem, and that you can count on one day so that you can take risks now without having to worry about that future. We require government to run good state universities. We require government to put police on the streets, firefighters to protect us, and of course, we have the military, which is doing such an astonishingly good job in Afghanistan, and which we're also so proud of. But you look at all of that, and there's a point where attacking it and its very existence is really an attack on the middle class. And you can always demand that we folks in government do better, but to go right at whether public schools should be adequate, that's where the debate's gotten a little overheated.
And to your point a little bit, oftentimes in these debates, federal employees are separated from the middle class as almost as if they're
like
two distinct groups.
Like they're somebody different, yeah.
But they're really one and the same.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about doctors and nurses who provide care to our veterans. You're talking about FBI agents who go out and investigate crimes. You're talking about Border Patrol agents who stand in the heat and the cold on our borders to defend them. You're talking about the people who keep our aircraft safe as they fly through the skies. You're talking about people in lab coats who are designing the technologies of tomorrow in National Institute of Health and National Science Foundation. You're talking about a lot of people who are doing incredible work and who we should be proud of, and throwing them kind of collectively under the bus, I think, isn't very fair.
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island. Senator, pleasure to meet you today. Thanks for your information and your time.
Jason, thank you for having me with you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll begin our congressional roundtable with Congressman Brad Miller of North Carolina.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Congressman Brad Miller from the 13th District in North Carolina. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Before we got on air, you and I had a nice conversation about the work that federal employees do in your state, particularly in agencies such as the Social Security Administration, Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Bureau of Prisons. Tell us a little bit about some of the information that you have about that.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm a child of public employees, of two public employees. My father worked for the post office and I think got that job in the 1930s and then held it to the day he died in 1965. And my mother was a bookkeeper for the local school system. So I did not grow up thinking that public employees did not earn their living. In fact, I saw them go to work every day and work pretty hard. And when we've had the attacks on public employees that we've had in our politics in the last couple of years, they were talking about my mama. I don't like it when people talk about my mama.
That's a personal thing.
Yeah.
That's a personal thing.
So I think public employees work pretty hard and take their job seriously and give the American people their money's worth. In my district, the AFGE members are largely in the Bureau of Prisons. I represent Butner, where there's a substantial prison facility. And, of course, they're just scattered around, like in people who work for Social Security, Veterans Administration, as you said. In fact, one of the leaders of the labor movement in North Carolina, but particularly the Triangle Central Labor Council, is Mike Gravenese, and he's a retired AFGE member. He's still an AFGE member, but he's a retired Social Security administrator of some kind.
In Congress, your body most closely touches the American people.
Right.
So when you hear arguments in Congress about cutting budgets for agencies, cutting the pay of federal employees, pensions, benefits, et cetera, how does that make you feel being someone who is so closely connected to the American people?
I think it's wildly unrealistic to think it's not going to affect what kind of services people get from their government. And, you know, another issue in which AFGE has been a leader, but unfortunately a leader what is often a losing cause, is the number of things that have been outsourced, that have been privatized. And if anybody was really serious about making government more efficient, making it cheaper, we would be looking very closely at whether it really makes sense to send out to private contractors a lot of what we send out. It costs us more. It doesn't. We probably don't get as good a return on our dollar.
One of the things that I think has gotten lost in the conversation is people have almost separated federal employees from middle class Americans, when in reality, they're one and the same.
Yeah,
we're talking about the VA nurse in your district who makes $35,000 a year, or the correctional officer or senior correctional officer at Butner who makes $45,000 a year. They are middle-class Americans. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Well, again, that's been my experience. The bread on my table growing up, the shoes on my feet, my tuition to college was paid for by public salaries because both my parents were public employees. My father got a job at the post office in the 1930s. In the rural small town south of the 1930s, a federal government job was a good job. He passed a test to get it, and that was his ticket to the middle class. That's what got my family into the middle class. And he worked hard for the American people. My mother worked hard for the people of Fayetteville, the community I grew up in.
And I imagine, as we talked about earlier, when you mentioned your mother, and you know, it's personal for you, and you yourself are a federal employee, you're a federal servant, so of course you have their best interests at heart as well, right?
Well, that's not true of all of my colleagues. I look around the House chamber, and I would say not all of them really think of themselves as public employees who are at one with the people, with your members, with AFGE members.
So let's talk a little bit about North Carolina's 13th district. Tell me what challenges your constituents face. What kinds of jobs are you hoping to create in the district? Mm-hmm. Give me a sense for what it's like to be a resident of the 13th district in North Carolina.
Well, the 13th district has been almost a microcosm of America. I guess a lot of members of Congress may think that about their districts, but in the Triangle area, the Raleigh part of my district, it really has come through the recession pretty well. I mean, that's not to say there hasn't been some real pain. There has been. But at the other end of my district, the western end of my district, has been where we've had real severe manufacturing job loss. Textiles, tobacco, even furniture. Most of the furniture industry in North Carolina is in another part of the state, but we've had some job loss, and we've had really painful manufacturing job loss. So we kind of began an economic transition even before this recession hit, but this recession has made it much more painful. I think we're trying to figure out how to build an economy that's like the economy we had for a half a century after the New Deal, and beginning with the New Deal, and for a half a century after that, of when the economy did better, when the nation did better, it was a broadly shared prosperity. We all did better. And actually, we all do better when we all do better. Even the people who are at the very top, the people who are the investors in major corporations, the people who are the CEOs of major corporations, do better if there is a prosperous middle class, because a prosperous middle class can buy what they make. You know, the biggest problem we've got right now in our economy is that consumers are under such pressure. Households, families are under such pressure because they've seen such a great loss in their net worth, their life savings, with the collapse in the value of their homes, and their lack of, they're not really knowing if they're going to keep their job, and they're not getting overtime, and they know if they lose their job, they'll probably have to take a job with less pay. That doesn't put people in a spending mood.
I think you make a great point, and I think it's something that should be noted, that almost regardless of what political party you're in, as a people, as a country, we're going to move forward or move back together.
I think that's right, but we've got a sliver of people at the top now, the richest people, many of whom, you know, the Republicans love to call them job creators. A lot of them have done nothing particularly helpful for the society as a whole to have gotten that rich. And they are much more interested in protecting their position than they are in helping the economy and the nation as a whole. And I think they may not think it through this way, but they would rather be a small elite in a country with a lot of people doing a whole lot less well than they are than to be doing very well in a country in which everybody's doing well.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Congressman Brad Miller, representing North Carolina's 13th District. Congressman, one of the things that we hear in the press quite a bit is this contentious atmosphere in Congress, not being able to work together, not being able to resolve issues and get things done. The American people say that Congress is broken, it needs to be fixed. I'm wondering, from someone in your position who's actually on the inside and does the work of the people every day, is that true or is that blown out of proportion? Are you able to get things done, or what's it really like in there?
It's every bit as bad as it looks. I think this is a very bad time in our nation's history for us to have a dysfunctional Congress. A columnist for the Washington Post and for Bloomberg named Ezra Klein wrote a piece a few weeks ago on the 10 reasons why this is the worst Congress ever. And like eight on the list was, this is a time the nation has real problems. We really need our political system to work to address the nation's problems, and the nation and the political system is dysfunctional. I look at the composition of Congress now. I don't really see the spirit of compromise. I don't see anything but belligerent scorcher of partisanship, and I can't see the present membership of Congress really moving past that. But there's got to be a reason the people who are there are there. There's got to be something wrong that needs fixing in our political system, in our society more generally.
That's a very interesting answer, and I'm wondering how that makes you feel personally to hear almost that referendum on, as a body, what you all are doing. You know, how does that make you feel to know that some people just aren't feeling very good about their representatives right now?
Yeah, there's certainly exceptions. I mean, I like to think that I'm one. There are exceptions of members who really are paying close attention, who are working hard, who have the nation's best interests at heart, and are willing to take political risks to do the right thing. But as a whole, no, Congress is not working. I think when I see the polls that show like 8% approve, I wonder who's that 8%. What is it they like about what they see in Congress right now? Because I'm definitely part of the 92% who does not approve of Congress.
What do you think it's going to take to change the minds of people? What can you do to say, hey, we're going to do whatever we can to make you see us in a different light, to get things done for you, to get your lives going in the right direction?
I think Congress will have more respect when Congress does better. If you go back 50 years, 40 years, and you ask the polling question, do you think most people in government do the right thing most of the time, or they want to do the right thing most of the time? Overwhelmingly, people said yes. I mean, they might disagree with certain policies, But they did not think the people who were governing the nation, who had been elected democratically, who had put their names on ballots, who had shaken hands and kissed babies and made speeches, they believed that those folks loved their country and wanted to do the right thing. And that was what I thought when I was in the state legislature. I mean, there were obviously some people in the state legislature who, in my heart of hearts, I found annoying. But for the most part, I thought all of my colleagues and were really there to do the best thing for the state. Right now, it feels like more members are there to push a partisan agenda and to repeat whatever the their party's talking point is for that day or that week. And it makes any real progress almost impossible. We've had one partisan message bill after another come to the floor of the House, and we've not really addressed the nation's really great needs.
Congressman Brad Miller from North Carolina's 13th District. Congressman, great to have you on the program, and thank you for your support in doing the work you do for the American people.
Thank you for what you do for the American people.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue our congressional roundtable with Representatives Tim Ryan of Ohio and Judy Chu of California.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Congressman Tim Ryan for the first time, who represents Ohio's 17th District. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
We have you here today at the Democratic National Convention, Day 2 in Charlotte.
Yes.
What is happening here?
We have action. Lots of action. We had a great night last night. I think if the conference ended, the convention ended tonight or today, I think we'd still get a bump based on, I think, Ted Strickland's speech last night. And Michelle Obama was just magnificent. She connected on so many levels.
A lot of powerful speeches. One that came to mind that I thought was particularly interesting was that of Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker. Just got a standing ovation and really fired up the crowd. What did you think about some of that stuff?
Yeah, he's terrific. I mean, he's a young, not even rising star, because he's a star. I mean, he's just one of the stars of the party. And I think really hands-on mayor and connected in big ways, and I think has a big vision for the party. So, you know, I think people get excited when they see what the future of the party looks like.
You're one of those younger members of the party, younger members of Congress. Where do you see your role and the role of some of your colleagues in the same age group as you taking the party in the years to come?
Well, I just think pragmatically outlining a vision for what our folks are going to do, what our neighborhoods are going to look like, what our food system's going to look like really big things. And I think there's an opportunity really with some investments to really reshape the way our neighborhoods look, urban farming, urban gardening, our food systems, what kind of technologies we invest into, how we push and lead the world in new forms of manufacturing. Those real practical things that I think high-speed rail, like what do we want America to look like in the next decade or two? And I think those of us who are under 40, I think can really paint that picture of what the kind of world we want. And it's an economic system, too, that that values time with our family. And I think a lot of us grew up in divorced homes, but yet maintained a real connection to our grandparents and our family. We hear a lot about family values. And I think our generation is starting to define it as valuing time with your family and having an economic system that allows for that.
You bring up some really great points there, and one of which is this investment in your neighborhood, investment in things like infrastructure. We know that the central issue of this election season is the economy and jobs. Do you see those investments that you referenced as a way to really kickstart the economy and get things going in the right direction?
Absolutely. Reshaping our neighborhoods. You know, we see it in places like Youngstown and Akron, where through the Obama administration, both through the stimulus bill and the financial reform bill, there were billions of dollars in there to take down the old dilapidated homes. Well, you start taking down 500 to 1,000 homes in a neighborhood or in a city, you're starting to have real impact, and you put up urban gardens and whatnot. You really are starting to transform the city. So how do we get resources down to these local neighborhoods that are being organized by community organizations and empower them to take hold and really have impact in their own neighborhoods? And I'm starting to see that. We're seeing it in Youngstown, Ohio. And if it's happening in Youngstown, Ohio, it can happen anywhere.
And that's a great point. And I think what you say about Youngstown, Ohio, and Ohio in general, is going to be a very, very important state in the election. What are your constituents saying to you about the state of the economy these days?
Well, it depends on who you are. You know, I mean, you know, it's a, what do they say? It's a recession when your neighbor loses his job, and it's a depression when you lose yours. So I think it's very situational. But overall, in Ohio, we are much, much better off because of the stimulus bill that put about $8 billion into the state, just plugging holes. And then we have seen huge benefits from the auto industry. And one in every eight jobs in Ohio is related to the auto industry in some way. And we in my congressional district we make the Chevy Cruze, three shifts at the auto plant, the supply chain, the seat manufacturer, the logistics company, the transportation company. You know, these are all people working in the ripple effect throughout the community. But we still have a long way to go because a lot of people are underemployed. Even though we have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country, we have people that are taking jobs now that are $5 or $10 less an hour than the one they had. So we've got a lot of work to do. But for Obama and Romney, it's about who's going to take us to the next level. And Romney's going to take us backwards to the policies that got us in the problem in the first place.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Congressman Tim Ryan from Ohio. Congressman, earlier on, you mentioned the importance of family. Tell me a little bit more about how much that will impact somebody's life, having a strong family around them.
Oh, it's everything. I mean, for one party to think that they have a hold on this basic human contract that we have with each other and connection that we have with each other. It's everything, and I think the statistics bear that out. Having said that, there are still things that we can do if you have caring, loving relationships, and people who care about you as a young kid, as a young child, could make all the difference. And part of that is really having time together. And so I think when we talk about health care, you talk about child care, you talk about making sure that someone doesn't have to work two or three jobs, both parents, and no one's watching the kids or giving the kind of attention needed to the kids. So how do we construct an economy? And I think back to my grandfather, who we talked a little off-air about, my Italian grandfather who worked at a steel mill. Good, solid living. He wasn't the wealthiest guy in town, but he had a nice, solid living, had a house, had a garden. He'd work till 3 o'clock every day, 7 to 3, come home. He would go right to his garden, you know, and then he would have happy hour with his brother-in-laws who all lived in the neighborhood. And then they would have a family dinner together, and on the weekends they'd have picnics and play bocce and throw the football and cook out. And he made enough money that he could have that time with my mom and my aunt, and it makes all the difference in the world. So our goal as young Democrats, as the new generation or however people call us, is that how do we create an economy that allows for what's most important? And what we all would probably say the most important is the people in our lives.
And someone in your position as a member of the House of Representatives, the body of government that touches people the most, how is it working in the House? We hear many reports about very contentious a very contentious time in the House of Representatives with Democrats and Republicans. Give us a sense for what it's like to be in that firsthand.
It is contentious, and there's no compromise. There is no let's work it out kind of thing, which, again, is not reflective of how your normal relationships work. I mean, I ask people all the time, like, are you married? Like, do you have more than one child, and you got to figure out where you're going to dinner tonight? And they start screaming, and you say, okay, Johnny, we go to your place tonight, and next week we go to Mary's favorite restaurant. That's it happens all the time. So for us to think that somehow it's not going to happen or shouldn't happen in Congress, we're going to be all or nothing, is really delusional. And I think people are tired of it, and I actually think the members of Congress are tired of it. And I think I'm hoping that after this election, we can shake this virus off that we've had for the past few years and really get about the business of the country.
What are you most hoping to see come out of this convention this week?
Well, if last night was any indication, we are going to see what I want to see, and that's letting the American people know that the president is really on their side. We have seen it in Ohio with the auto industry. We've seen it in Ohio with investments in education and Pell Grants and police and fire. And he's on our team, you know, and you're not going to agree with him 100% of the time. I don't agree with him 100% of the time. I have beefs with the president. But my goodness gracious, this guy has been on our team. And, you know, I used to have disagreements with my football coaches and with guys I played football and basketball with. But my goodness gracious, you know, we're in agreement 80% of the time, so let's go. He's been on our side, you know, and for people in Ohio to think that somehow their Medicare program is going to get privatized. Somehow the Medicaid budget is going to get cut by $800 billion, and they're going to have to go in their own pockets to pay for their mom and dad to go into a nursing home is unconscionable. And what stands between that philosophy getting implemented and not getting implemented is President Obama. He's on our team.
That's a great point, I think, just to note that everyone here is on the same team. And Americans in general, we're all on the same team and got to come together to fix these problems.
Yeah, and it's not either or. You know, it's not all government or no government. It's a blend. It's how does it happen? Okay, we need roads and bridges. We need a trained workforce. We need somebody to do the research that one company can't possibly do on their own. So as we organize our society, that's the role of the National Institutes of Health. That's the role of, you know, the Department of Education to give money and for us to make these investments, because we know that making those investments yield more value than the money we've put in. It's a great investment. So the conversation should be, what's the balance? What's the right amount? And it's not all or nothing.
Congressman Tim Ryan from Ohio's 17th District, it's a pleasure to see you here, a pleasure
to
meet you, and thanks for coming on the program.
Anytime.
We've been joined by Congresswoman Judy Chu from the 32nd District in California. Congresswoman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We are excited to see you here today, of course, at the kickoff day for the Democratic National Convention here in Charlotte. What have you done so far that's of note?
I'm so excited to be here. Actually, I'm preparing because I will be speaking tomorrow night.
What are you hoping to convey to the audience at that time?
I want to draw out the differences between President Obama and Romney. The main thing that I'll be talking about is that Romney doesn't care and that President Obama does care about the American people. I'm going to draw upon my own experience and background as somebody who came from an immigrant family. My grandfather came here as an immigrant, and yet he was able to achieve the American dream, even though he faced all kinds of hardships. And the American dream is what President Obama will be able to provide for millions of Americans in the next 4 years.
Have you been able to work closely with the president on issues such as small business, where you sit on that committee?
Yes, I think that the president has been extremely proactive in this area. He's enacted 18 small business tax cuts. He's actually done numerous measures to make it easier for small businesses to invest, grow, and hire. He has cut down federal regulations so that small business contractors can get easier payments and so that they can access the federal contracting system even more easily. So he has definitely been an advocate for small business.
I want to follow up on something that you just said about the president's initiatives to cut down on federal regulations. I'm not sure that that's something that the American people would know very much about the president. Could you expand on that a little bit?
He has tried to make it easier for small businesses to operate. And yes, people do not know that he actually did take the initiative to make things smoother for small businesses, including in the federal contracting arena. He has, in particular, made it easier for the small business to get their money from a prime contractor. This is a problem because prime contractors actually have the main source of business with, say, the Defense Department. But they will have numerous small contractors, and unless these small contractors are able to get their money in a timely way, then it's a problem for them.
Congresswoman, how important is it for small businesses to thrive in order for this economy to get back on track again?
Small businesses comprise the vast majority of businesses in the United States. And two out of every three new jobs are created by small businesses. If we want to see an economic recovery, and all of us want to see that, then we have to really give a big boost to small business.
As we look ahead to Election Day, the central focus will be on job creation. What is the best way to accomplish that goal?
I believe that we must invest in our economy. We must invest in transportation systems that will rebuild our aging infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, our highways. We must build schools that are aging and make them better for our kids. But also with that, we will be able to have those good construction jobs that will ensure that people will be getting back to work. But we also must make sure that we remain the greatest innovators in the world. With innovation, we will have the industries that are here that will provide the jobs of the future. And of course, we must become a green economy, because one area where there can be a source of many new jobs are those pertaining to green types of companies like solar industries and so forth.
Congresswoman, what's the most pressing issue in your district these days?
It is jobs and the economy. I have areas in my district that have unemployment rates that are as high as 17%, like in East L.A.
What are those people saying to you in that part of your district about what they want to see from an economy in the United States?
They want to see more opportunity for jobs, more opportunity for their children to go to school and live a better life in the future.
Congresswoman Judy Chu, representing California's 32nd District. Congresswoman, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll address voter protection initiatives with former Obama White House communications advisor Corey Elons.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab, or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Corey Elons, the Senior Vice President of Vox Global and a former Obama White House communications advisor. Corey, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
We, of course, are at an exciting time at the Democratic National Convention here in Charlotte. What are you hoping to see out of the week?
Well, this is the beginning of the fourth quarter, and it's tremendously exciting because this week we have a chance to talk about the tremendous strides we've made over the past 3.5 years with President Obama at the helm, and to talk about the definition of Ford, the motto of the campaign. What is it that a future America will look like with President Obama still in the White House, still in the Oval Office? And finally, we have a chance to, quite frankly, correct the record and to strike a sincere contrast between our convention and what we saw last week in Tampa from the Republicans. It's a big week, and I think we're going to have a great story to tell.
You mentioned working to keep President Obama in the White House. In order for that to happen, of course, people need to get out and vote.
No question.
And one of the big issues in this voting cycle is this idea of voter ID laws at the state level. Tell me your thoughts on where that issue is today.
Well, imagine playing a football game for four quarters, getting down to the last 2 minutes, and then changing the rules of the game. And basically, that's what you see happening in states all over the country, especially in states that, quite frankly, are being run by Republican governors and Republican administrations, where they are attempting to change the voting requirements at the last minute. And study after study has demonstrated that these changes will have a dramatic and disproportionate impact on African Americans, Hispanics, and the elderly, quite frankly, serving as a voter suppression effort that will ultimately help to work around the margins to diminish our turnout and to get the opposition elected. I saw it up close and personal in Ohio in 2004. So I know it can work, and that's why I know we really need to be on this, and we need to make sure we get people out to vote this cycle.
Corey, not long ago we had on AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt Baker, and she referenced these tactics as modern-day poll tax. What are your thoughts on that?
That's absolutely no question. When you consider, now they got around the rule in Mississippi by saying, okay, we'll give you the voter registration card or we'll give you the voter ID card, but you're still going to need to have a birth certificate and no other ID will be accepted, a birth certificate. Now, when you think about it, a birth certificate generally costs anywhere between $12 to $15. That's a tax that someone has to pay in order to vote, and because they have to have the card to do so. So that is absolutely the case. And when you look at states like Ohio, and you look at states like Pennsylvania in particular, where you have 750,000 people right now who do not have the proper ID to vote on Election Day, and many of them have no clue that they need this ID and will show up to the polls without it and be turned away, again, that is a institutionalized voter suppression tactic that is being put in place, and it's just wrong in 21st century America.
The number of people that you referenced there, that's a number that could swing the election.
Oh, no question. Again.
In a state like Pennsylvania.
No question. When you take a look again at Ohio in 2004, that race was not as close as 2000, to be sure, but it was very close. It was one of our closest races historically. That race turned in the state of Ohio on over 500,000 votes. And why is that? It was because of the voter rules that were put in place late in the game by the state, the Ohio Secretary of State, that disadvantaged African Americans in particular, and it worked. So that's their playbook, and they're going to try it again this year. But we know it, and we need to be able to defend it as if it is our goal line. That is our goal line. They can't beat us on the issues. They can't beat us on ideas. They got to cheat in order to get it done. We have states that had tremendous access in 2008, early voting extended, early voting on weekends, motor voter being implemented in states all over the country. All those pieces, all those efforts to expand the franchise, to give more people an opportunity to vote, are being restricted, are being pulled back, are being clawed back this cycle. Because what was the result? Barack Obama became president, and we had the highest participation rate in voting in the history of the country. Why would you want to turn that back unless it was clearly in the favor of your party and the person who you want to be elected? That's the only reason at the end of the day.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Corey Elans, the Senior Vice President of Vox Global, as well as former Obama White House Communications Advisor. Corey, you mentioned earlier trying to beat you on the ideas. You said the Republicans can't beat the Democrats on ideas. Let's talk about some of those ideas.
Mm-hmm.
What are some ideas that President Obama's administration has come up with in the last 4 years?
Well, I tell you, and people get tired of hearing this, especially conservatives, but you have to put what we've been through in the past 3.5 years in context. When President Obama came into office, we were losing 750,000 jobs a month. Our entire economy was on the brink of collapse. We were about to lose the auto industry. And we were about to see an America that we hadn't seen in over 70 years since the Great Depression. President Obama, even during the transition period, began to exert leadership on the situation. He came into, within days of being inaugurated, came in and introduced what turned out to be the stimulus bill. That eventually passed. And while it didn't do, it wasn't the magic potion that we needed to dramatically erase all of our ills at that moment, it did put us on the right track. to making our way towards economic prosperity. We're still not there. We have a long way to go, and that's exactly why we can't change horses in the middle of the race. Also, too, look at what we've done with the Affordable Care Act. There are programs and policies that are in place today and more to come in 2014 that will be rolled back if the opposition party is allowed to take hold in 2013. There's so many things. That's domestically. You look at foreign policy. As the vice president likes to say, and I like to quote him, Osama bin Laden is dead. General Motors is alive and thriving. That's because this president was in charge. You can't necessarily say that would be the case. And as a matter of fact, we know it wouldn't be the case because Mitt Romney said, look, the auto industry shouldn't get any special handouts, any special bailouts. We need to let the housing market self-correct and bail out, bomb out before it starts to correct itself. These are all things that he has said. So we know from a substantive standpoint what would have happened if Mitt Romney had been president over the past 4 years. We can't allow him to be president for the next 4 years.
What was it like working in the White House for President Obama?
It is, quite frankly, an extraordinary opportunity to work for this president during this incredible time in our nation's history. Again, you can only compare it to what we saw 70 years ago during the Great Depression. Many milestones achieved, and quite frankly, the majority of those milestones achieved without the assistance and support of Congress. A lot of this the president has done with one arm tied behind his back, but it was an extraordinary opportunity for me as a young African-American male from Birmingham, Alabama, whose parents marched during the Civil Rights Movement. It was an extraordinary opportunity for me. And that's the other thing I want people to appreciate as well, is that we've come a long way as a country, as a community. We have so much further to go. And it is the policies of the Democratic Party and this president that are going to move us forward. I think we'll have a chance to hear a lot more about that this week, and I'm excited about the opportunity to do so.
Is there a story that you can share with us about the president, or a little-known fact that the American public wouldn't know, that you would only know from working in the White House?
Oh, sure. I have a couple, but this is my favorite because it's very personal to me. I have a 4-year-old son, and we were doing an interview with one of the national magazines, and it was about education. And so the president, you know, he'd had a long day. He came in. He was ready for the interview, but he was kind of hanging back a bit and just trying to feel it out. And they asked him about Sasha and Malia. And they said, what advice would you give to parents about how they should educate their own children? And he immediately perked up and started talking about the rules and roles that he has put in place for his own children, because he believes that education, especially for his two girls, is the best gift that he or anyone could possibly give to them. They don't turn the TV on during the week. They come in, they eat dinner, they do their homework. They don't go to bed until they finish their homework. And all these rules and regulations that he has in place, and I don't mean it to sound as if he is, you know, an overseer in that way, but he's just had an opportunity to see what education has meant in his own life and how it has afforded him the opportunities to be, you know, president of the United States and leader of the free world. It removed all the issues associated with being an African-American in this country and allowed him to move forward. He wants those same opportunities for all children in this country. And it was just really amazing to watch him talk about that so personally in his own family and what it meant to him.
Corey Elan's the senior vice president of Vox Global, as well as a former Obama White House communications advisor. Corey, great to see you again. Thanks for coming on the
Thank
program.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you to our guests this week, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, and Representatives Brad Miller, Tim Ryan, and Judy Chu. Also, thank you to former Obama White House communications advisor Corey Elans. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you by the American Federation of Government Employees. Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.